Okay, I want to shift to a discussion of chemotherapy in the HER2-negative patient, and we're starting out with a septuagenarian flavor here. We have Dr. Simon present her case, please.
The patient was a 78-year-old woman who noted a painless lump in her right breast and quickly sought medical attention. A mammogram was done and confirmed the mass. On exam, there was a 5-centimeter mass in the right breast and a 2-centimeter palpable right axillary lymph node. A core biopsy of the mass showed invasive lobular carcinoma. Estrogen and progesterone receptors were both strongly positive. HER2-new was 1+. She underwent a right-modified radical mastectomy. At surgery, histology showed a 4.5-centimeter tumor and 2 of 30 lymph nodes were positive. She received postoperative radiation therapy, and the decision was made regarding her systemic therapy.
Can you talk a little bit about this woman, what comorbidities she had and her lifestyle?
She was completely healthy. She's married. She lives with her husband, lives a normal life.
And what was her attitude about therapy in general? Was she concerned more about toxicity, about preventing recurrence, or sort of in between? Or was she more like, doc, what should I do?
No, she was totally opposed to chemotherapy. She was totally opposed. No real reason.
Okay, so again, we have another 78-year-old lady who doesn't much like the idea of adjuvant chemotherapy. That, by way of background, we'll kind of keep that in our mind. Maybe we want to say to her, okay, fine, you don't want chemotherapy, but let me explain to you what the potential benefits and risks might be for you to consider. And certainly one of the most pressing questions in general, I think, in chemotherapy is the optimal regimen in the higher risk, particularly node-positive patient. So I'm going to ask Cliff to address the question. Again, the 78-year-old woman, 2 positive nodes, ER-positive, HER2-negative tumor. If instead of being very reluctant about chemotherapy, she said, listen, I want you to do everything you can, reduce my risk of relapse, how would you respond?
Well, if she wants chemotherapy, we would treat her with docetaxel paclitaxel. There was no upper age limit in the clinical trial. About 12% of the patients were above age 60, and Artie Heria at our center has actually studied specifically octogenarians treated with chemotherapy and has identified relative safety for it. So we're not so concerned if we have to treat.
And she says, Dr. Hodes, I've been on the internet and I see all this controversy about docetaxel ACT versus TAC in people like me with ER-positive tumors.
If you gave me another 15-minute slot, I'd be happy to go through that. There is no question that in the Oxford overview and across the board in every study virtually ever done, including the TACFAC trial, there's clear evidence of a greater magnitude of benefit for ER-negative patients who receive chemo than those in the ER-positive subset. In the TAC-to-FAC comparison, the ER-positive subset is statistically significant. In some of the other trials, it is not. But from my point of view right now, you have to recognize that there is likely to be a fair bit of noise in the system. They had the advantage of centralized ER testing in that trial and control over the hormone therapy. When we did our studies in the CLGB, we actually recommended but didn't stipulate hormone therapy. We didn't do centralized ER testing, and so our results in terms of generating hypotheses have to be seen as just that. Our hypothesis is this. Chemotherapy is, on average, less effective in ER-positive breast cancer than ER-negative. I don't think that's a big stretch.
Before I ask John to comment on the same issue, just one follow-up. You said you would offer her docetaxel chemotherapy, Cliff. She's 78. Is there sort of an age limit at which you just won't give chemotherapy?
Well, I actually would be tempted to treat this patient without chemotherapy anyway. What you presented to me is a patient who walks in and demands it. Well, I won't put an age number on there because I really can't. But certainly above age 80, it's exceedingly rare for us to give adjuvant chemotherapy to almost any patient. We do it, but it's very rare. Those patients usually have ER-positive disease.
And, you know, there was a lot of controversy about this in the San Antonio meeting. Dr. Picard gave the opening address addressing this question of chemotherapy in the ER-positive patients. You're saying 78 years old in general, ER-positive tumor, 2 positive nodes, you would consider not giving a chemotherapy?
Yeah, I would.
What about 58?
I would be much less comfortable at 58. And the reason for this is that whatever small benefit chemotherapy may offer in ER positives is likely to play out over many, many years. And you need to have a long life expectancy to see that difference. If you'll allow me, ER positive breast cancer has a long chronic relapse track ahead of it. Interestingly, and not many people appreciate this, by 30 years after diagnosis, it doesn't matter whether you had ER-positive or negative disease untreated. The overall risk of relapse and the overall survival is actually the same. So the notion that ER-positive disease is overall a better disease is undermined. What's different about it is the timing of the recurrences. So with ER-positive disease, you will see the impact of therapy over the long haul. With ER-negative, you'll see it right up front. And so for a young patient with a long life expectancy, I wouldn't be so quick to forego that potential benefit. But the older you get, the longer you have to live to see the potential benefits, the more likely you are to not get there.
John?
Well, for the most part, I agree with Cliff's comments. But I just want to point out that we've struggled over the last 5 or 6 years with regards to HER2 testing and really what is the right way to do it. And I think we finally agreed you need a good reproducible assay and a good centralized laboratory. Now, estrogen receptor is in many cases a much more important signal that we need to make our treatment decisions, and we tend to rely on ad hoc, uncontrolled, non-quantitative, non-reproducible assessments for our patient care. And if I would just make one recommendation to any practitioners who are listening to this, you might want to go back and quiz your laboratory and find out what have they actually done to validate their hormone receptor status. Because to make the mistake of offering an ER-positive woman no hormonal therapy is probably the biggest sin you can make in adjuvant treatment. So just make sure that, in fact, your lab knows what it's doing. And again, we had the benefit of a central review for our estrogen receptor data on the 001 trial. And I agree with Cliff, this may be part of the reason why we're clearly defining a benefit in that population, where the contamination of the ER negatives in other studies may obviate that. I would suggest that you really get a handle on your own local ability to determine ER status.
It kind of reminds me of a joke that I have to say, which is there's a saying that all normal children are orphans because everybody's kid's so spectacular. I have yet to meet the person who says, you know, our lab just sucks at ER testing.
Just to follow up, though, more specifically, John, getting back to Dr. Simon's case, 78-year-old woman, ER-positive tumor, 2 positive nodes. First scenario, she wants to do everything she can to reduce risk of relapse.
Well, I'd still try to talk her out of chemotherapy. I think the advantage is probably trivial, and it's untested. And if you want sometimes to show that to people, you can go to adjuvantonline.com and enter in this lady's age and her potential comorbidities. And if you want to be blunt, basically she's likely to die of something else, and the chemo isn't probably going to change that much. And sometimes you have to actually resort to hard numbers, even though they're estimates, to drive your point home. And I've been surprised at the trainees who come through our system, at their surprise at the marginal benefits that chemotherapy affords the older ER-positive population just using that program.
Same numbers, 58-year-old woman.
Oh, very much. We'd want to treat her with chemotherapy. And although I admit that we don't have cross-trial comparisons, my bias is that in the ER-positive population, we'll use TAC. We know that it works clearly in ER-positive disease. Probably paclitaxel does as well. But again, I'm just not as comfortable with the data sets that have been derived to demonstrate that there really is a major difference. I don't feel as strongly about that today as I did 1 month ago. Because with the 1199 study not showing a clear signal between the taxanes, I'm less inclined to believe that there is a taxane ER-specific interaction that might have been indicated. I think it's probably largely differences in the trial design and conduct.
But also, just to clarify, I'm going to guess that even if the tumor were ER-negative, you'd prefer TAC, or not so strongly.
Well, again, I think not as strongly, because we know clearly that dose-dense AC Taxol is a very effective regimen. We are participating in B38. So we offer our patients this trial, and I agree that there is still equipoise as to that question. The one potential advantage of docetaxel over paclitaxel, as I see it today, is that perhaps giving your anthracycline concurrently with your taxane, your two best drugs together, could make a difference in cure. If you consider most other malignancies, combination therapy of curative intent is not as likely to be sequential. It tends to be combination regimens. You can't do combination anthracycline paclitaxel adjuvant therapy in general because of cardiotoxicity. You can do it with docetaxel. If there is truly a big advantage, it'll come from that, I think.
It's interesting. I never thought about that. So you're comfortable randomizing a patient with an ER-positive tumor to the NSABP trial?
I am. I still think there is equipoise there. Off trial, though, my best guess in ignorance, but my best guess is that TAC would probably be the better bet at present.
Okay, Dr. Simon, can you follow up with what happened with this woman?
Well, she was placed on Arimidex, and I put her on Fosamax because she had some osteopenia, and she's been doing well. It's over a year since her surgery.
Any side effects or problems with the anastrozole?
None whatsoever.
You said she was osteopenic?
Osteopenic, yes.
She was osteopenic. Cliff, two positive nodes, ER positive, PR positive, but she's osteopenic. What do you think about anastrozole or an AI?
I think it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, the ER and PR subset analysis is really interesting, but it isn't actually consistently seen even across the AI trials right now. And I actually would be biased in favor of the AI independent of what subset you're looking at there by ER.
John?
Well, I agree, but I think that we also have to get these women on calcium and vitamin D and weight-bearing exercise. And those lifestyle issues are very important ones too. So I'm sure you've already done that. But I routinely recommend for all women on an AI that they get 1,500 milligrams of calcium, 800 units of vitamin D. I talk to them about exercise, in part because we've done randomized trials in our center showing that the quality of life benefits from exercise are far better than any of the other reported interventions, group psychotherapy, tree hugging, whatever is popular that day. Exercise makes a difference. And so the AI is just a real excuse for me to hammer home these lifestyle issues. And keep in mind, for a postmenopausal woman with our success rate in ER-positive breast cancer, she may have a bigger issue with cardiovascular disease, and certainly exercise is helpful there as well.
Do you advise her that there's some data, which to my understanding there is, suggesting that maybe exercise can actually reduce the relapse rate?
Well, that data, in part, also comes from an Alberta study, but the reality is it's not, the data I've seen is not randomized. What we're talking about is data from studies which look at populations and essentially epidemiologic data. And we all know from our lovely experience with the Women's Health Initiative study that epidemiologic data can lead you down the garden path, and to really know what you're doing, you need a randomized trial. Now, we've designed a trial that will be looking at endpoints that might relate to relapse, but we don't have adequate power to do anything but surrogate markers.
Cliff, is there a group of node-negative patients that you feel are high risk enough at this time to add a taxane?
To answer your question differently, you know, what we have here are sort of two axes of risk. One is geography. Are the nodes involved or not? And that's always been a surrogate for distant mets. But the other axis is biology, which is what's the receptor status. So a high-risk node-negative patient is, in all these trials that have included them, a patient with ER-PR-negative disease. So for a patient who has node-negative disease but is triple-negative, for example, we actually are learning that they are very high-risk patients, and we would treat those patients as we treat node-positives. That is, for sure, in many ways, overstepping the limits of the currently available data, but I don't think it's unreasonable. Those patients' early risk of recurrence is higher than the ER-positive patients who, by node status, were eligible for the trials.
Dr. Friedman?
I appreciate Dr. Mackey's comments regarding the potential synergy of concurrent docetaxel with an anthracycline. We had the opportunity to participate in both BCIRG001 and dose dense, and I find that the difference in toxicity is substantial, that the TAC regimen is extremely toxic, and we've been amazed at the ease of administration of the dose dense regimen. So although they may be equally efficacious, I hope that the NSABP trial shows us what that answer is. In our community practice, we have favored dose dense just because of the reduced side effect profile.
Can I just ask a question before you go on? Did you use growth factor for the TAC when you were using it? Because on the study, it was not allowed, right?
That's correct.
Right, but that could skew your perspective.
And that's exactly my point. I believe that TAC without growth factors is more toxic than AC dose dense. But we have data from a trial where Miguel Martin in Spain treated node-negative patients with TAC or FAC. And in that trial, they got a little ways into the trial and thought, gee, for node-negative disease, this TAC is quite tough. And they mandated G-CSF. And at that point, they found that the tolerability of the G-CSF went up dramatically. I mean, it's not a randomized trial. It's sort of an intervention halfway through. But they found that not only did the febrile neutropenia rate drop, but the mucositis, the fatigue, the diarrhea, And in addition, the quality of life decrements that come with chemotherapy also were less after G-CSF was initiated. So at the end of the day, I completely agree with you that naked TAC without growth factor is probably tougher than dose dance with growth factor. However, I think that difference would be much less if you use primary prophylaxis with Neulasta or Neupogen. I would suggest that if you were going to use it, I would use it with growth factor support. And that's my preference here. And I should have stated that up front. So thank you.
John, I was talking to Gary Lyman. Of course, you know, he does a lot of studies on patterns of care. And actually, we found in our own CME group's patterns of care studies, and I know both of you, Cliff and John, have participated in these, at least in the United States, there's no doubt the most common regimen that's utilized in node-positive patients is dose dense ACT, much higher than anything else. One of the things that was interesting, though, is in the last year, we've seen a flip in the number two. And number two has gone from AC docetaxel to now TAC. And I'm guessing it's probably, we were talking before about the NSABP B27 data kind of turned people off to AC docetaxel. But the thing that Gary told me that was totally shocking is I assumed that everybody knew that if you use TAC, based on what you just talked about, you use growth factors. And yet, according to his fairly recent patterns of care studies where he goes into practices and actually sees what people receive, like half of the TAC being given in this country is not being given with growth factors. Does that sound right? You guys in the community, does that sound possible?
No.
Maybe it's a methodologic problem of how he's getting the data, but I mean, to me, I assume most people knew that standard of care. Cliff, is that your take?
The only thing I can think is that some people who maybe are literally reading the drug approval in the adjuvant setting and following the label, because unfortunately the label explicitly doesn't talk about, if I remember, the use of G-CSF, but anybody that's used the regimen or paid attention, I think should know that G-CSF is required with that.
Do you agree with John's assessment that if you do use growth factors, that TAC and dose dense are roughly the same in terms of side effects and tolerability?
I couldn't begin to answer that question. We need randomized data for that.
Dr. Dragon?
I just want to add a comment to what Dr. Friedman said. And we put a number of patients on 1199, and we actually had one death due to tiflitis on the AC to Q3 week taxotere arm, docetaxel arm, in a 32-year-old. So my partners and I, now with the data being reported, will probably never put another patient on an arm besides the weekly taxol arm. From a toxicity standpoint, weekly taxol seems so much easier, despite my 76-year-old woman's experience, than the 100-milligram taxotere arm.
Dr. Ostro?
Cliff, just to clarify, on the Q2 versus Q3 week study, apparently the data shows that all the benefit for Q2 is in the ER-negative subgroup. Are you saying that that's just hypothesis generating, or do you believe that that difference really holds up?
The data doesn't say that. What the data says is that there is a robust point estimate for benefit in the ER negatives. In the ER positives, there's a confidence interval that is wide enough to include no benefit. It's very different. It's not saying all the benefits there. And if I could expand for one moment, this is a long story, because when you look across the board at chemotherapy and ER positive, first you look at our data and you say, okay, I'm not convinced that chemotherapy adds in ER positives. That's a very conservative take-home message from the three CLGB trials. But then you have to deal with the SWOG study, which took node-positive, ER-positive patients, randomize them to get or not get CAF, and shows a robust benefit, then subsets them and says, ah, but the robust benefit's only there in a substantial subset whose ER status isn't so positive. And then you do have to deal with the genomic health test, the Oncotype DX, that essentially shows you the same thing in node-negative ER-positive patients. So what I'm driving at is this. There is no doubt that the average benefit in ER-positive patients is less for chemotherapy. But to my mind, there's also no doubt that there are subsets of ER-positive patients who benefit tremendously from chemo, and there is no ability in clinical practice today to parse that out. And given that, the greater harm would be in withholding the best chemo from that population. To go one step further, I suspect that in the future, you will subset your ER-positives into those who do benefit from chemo and those who don't benefit, and you'll make decisions that way. But I posit that you can't do that today.
It's funny how so much attention now is on chemotherapy for ER-positive patients. It was one of the most interesting things, I think, that came out of San Antonio when Martine Picard kind of made some interesting statements about that and very controversial. Vincente?
We had been giving weekly paclitaxel for many years, and the question is dose dense any better than AC followed by weekly paclitaxel to us, we think weekly paclitaxel is a very easy agent to use. You have to use growth factor for every 2 weeks paclitaxel. Well, that's the way that the trial was done. And it clearly, it will be less expensive, in my opinion, probably may have less toxicity.
So these are key points that will be answered by trials. We have a clinical trial right now with dose-dense AC paclitaxel where we omit growth factor support during the paclitaxel. A lot of clinicians claim that they can do this and do this successfully. There's been no data, so we're generating that right now. And it's a futility analysis kind of trial. If 16 or fewer patients out of the first 20 fail to get through without growth factor support, we will conclude you do need it with the paclitaxel, which addresses one of your questions. The second one is the relative value of weekly versus Q2 at full dose, and that's just not answered. There is a SWOG study accruing right now with Tom Budd as the PI that will address that question, so we just don't know. One thing, though, that you could do, and I say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but if you accept that in the dose-dense trial there was an advantage for Q2 versus Q3 over standard paclitaxel and standard AC, and then you look at 1199 and you see no differences, you could sort of say, well, there may be an advantage to the Q2 full dose scheduling. After all, weekly didn't beat Q3 in that trial. There was no data trend.